Chapter 2. London and Harrogate. The Bayswater Club, owned by the Royal Academy of Sciences, sat across from Kensington Gardens, commanding a view of trimmed lawns and roses and cleverly pruned trees. St. Ives peered out the window on the second floor of the club, satisfied with what he saw. The sun loomed like an orange just below the zenith, and the radiant heat glancing through the germinate windows of the club felt almost alive. The April weather was so altogether pleasant that it came near to making up for the fearful lunch that would at any moment arrive to stare at Ives from a china plate. He'd attempted a bit of cheerful banter with the stony-faced waiter, ordering dirt cutlets and beer, but the man hadn't seen the humor in it. What he had seen had been evident on his face. St. Ives sighed and wished heartily that he was taking the sun along with the multitudes in the park. But the thought that a week hence there mightn't be a park at all, or any multitudes either, sobered him, and he drained the bottom half of a glass of claret. He regarded the man seated across from him. Parsons, the ancient secretary of the Royal Academy, spooned up broth with an enthusiasm that left St. Ives tired. Floating on the surface of the broth were what appeared to be twisted little bugs, but which must have been some sort of oriental mushroom sprinkled on by a chef with a sense of humor. Parsons chased them with his spoon. "So have you nothing at all to fear," said Parsons, dabbing at his chin with a napkin. He grinned at St. Ives in a satisfied way, as if proud of himself. "The greatest minds in the scientific world are at work on the problem. The comet will sail past us with no commotion whatsoever. It's a matter of electromagnetic forces, really. The comet might easily be drawn to the Earth, unless, of course, the Earth's magnetic field were forcibly suspended."
Suspended?
"It's not unknown to have happened. Common knowledge has it that the magnetic poles have reversed themselves any number of times, and that during the interim, between the establishing of new poles, the Earth was blessedly free of any electromagnetic field whatsoever. I'm surprised a physicist such as yourself has to be informed of such a thing." Parsons peered at St. Ives over the top of his pince-nez and fished up out of his broth the tendril of an unidentifiable vegetable. St. Ives gaped at it. "Kelp," said the secretary, slathering the dripping weed into his mouth and chomping away lustily. St. Ives nodded, a shiver running up along his spine. The pink chicken breast that lay beneath wilted lettuce on his plate began suddenly to fill him with a curious sort of dread. His lunches with Parsons at the Bayswater Club invariably went so. The secretary was always one up on him simply because of the food. "So what exactly do you intend? To hope such an event into existence?" "Not at all," said Parsons smugly. "We're building a device."
"A device?"
"To reverse the polarity of the Earth, thereby negating any natural affinity the Earth might have for the comet, and vice versa."
"Impossible," said St. Ives,
a kernel of doubt and fear beginning to sprout within him.
"Hardly," Parsons waved his fork with an air of gaiety, then scratched the end of his nose with it.
"No less a personage than Lord Kelvin himself is at work on it, although the theoretical basis of the thing was entirely a product of James Clerk Maxwell. Maxwell's 16 equations in tensor calculus demonstrated a good bit beyond the idea that gravity is merely a form of electromagnetism. But his conclusions, taken altogether, had such terrible and far-reaching side implications that they were never published. Lord Kelvin, of course, has access to them, and I think that we have little to fear that, in such benevolent hands, Maxwell's discoveries will lead to anything but scientific advancement. To more, actually, to the temporary reversal of the poles, as I said, and the switching off, as it were, of any currents that would attract our comet. Trust us, sir. This threat, as you call it, is a threat no more." St. Ives sat silently for a moment, wondering if any objection would penetrate into Parsons' head past the crunching of vegetation. Quite likely not, but he had to try. 2 days earlier, when he'd assured his friends in Dover that they'd easily come across Ignacio Narbondo, he hadn't bargained on this. Was it possible that the clever contrivances of Lord Kelvin and the Royal Academy would constitute a graver threat than that posed by the hunchback doctor? It wasn't to be thought of. Yet here was Parsons, full of talk about reversing the polarity of the Earth. St. Ives was duty-bound to speak. He seemed to find himself continually at odds with his peers. "Have you read the works of young Rutherford?"
"Pinwinny Rutherford of Edinburgh?"
"Ernest Rutherford, of New Zealand. I ran across him in Canada. He's done some interesting work in the area of light rays, if you can call them that." St. Ives wiggled loose a thread of chicken, carried the morsel halfway to his mouth, looked at it, and changed his mind. "There's some indication that alpha and beta rays from the sun slide away along the Earth's magnetic field, arriving harmlessly at the poles. It seems likely, at a hasty glance, that without the field they'd sail in straight away. We'd be bathed in radioactivity.
the most frightful mutations might occur. It has been my pet theory, in fact, that dinosaurs were laid low in precisely the same fashion, that their demise was a consequence of the reversal of the poles and the inherent cessation of the magnetic field. Parsons shrugged. All of this is theory, of course, but the comet is 8 days away, and that's not at all theory. It's an enormous chunk of iron that threatens to smash us into jelly. From your chair across the table, it's easy enough to fly in the face of the Academy, but I'm afraid, sir, that Lord Kelvin will get along very well without you. He has in the past. There's a better way, said St. Ives simply. It was useless to lose one's temper over Parsons' practiced stubbornness. Oh, said the secretary. Ignacio Narbondo, I believe, has showed it to us. Parsons dropped his spoon into his lap and launched into a choking fit. St. Ives held up a constraining hand. I'm very much aware of his threats, I assure you, and they're not idle threats, either. Do you propose to pay him? I'm constrained from discussing it. He'll do what he claims. He's taken the first steps already. What has this to do with your better way? He intends, if I read him correctly, to effect the stoppage of certain very active volcanoes in Arctic Scandinavia via the introduction of petrifacting catalysts into open fissures and dikes. The subsequent detonation of an explosive charge would lead to the eruption of a chain of volcanic mountains that rise above the jungles of Amazonia and Peru. The entrapped energy expended by such an upheaval would, he hopes, cast us like a Chinese rocket into the course of the comet. Given the structure of the interior of the Earth, said Parsons, grinning into his mineral water, it seems a dubious undertaking at best. Perhaps, are you familiar with the hollow Earth theory? Parsons blinked at St. Ives, the corners of his mouth twitched. Specifically with the work of McClung Jones of the Quebec Geological Mechanics Institute, the thin crust phenomenon. Parsons shook his head tiredly. It's possible, said St. Ives, that Narbondo's detonation will affect a series of eruptions in volcanoes residing in the hollow core of the Earth. The stupendous inner Earth pressures would themselves trigger an eruption at Jones's thin crust point. Thin crust point? Asked Parsons in a plonking tone. The very Peruvian mountains towards which our man Narbondo has cast the glad eye. That's an interesting notion, muttered Parsons, coughing into his napkin. He stared out the window, blinking his eyes ponderously, as if satisfied that St. Ives had concluded his speech. What I propose, said St. Ives, pressing on, is to thwart Narbondo and then effect the same thing, only in reverse. To propel the Earth temporarily out of her orbit in a long arc that would put the comet beyond her grasp. If the calculations were fined down sufficiently, and I can assure you that they have been, we'd simply slide back into orbit some few thousand miles farther along our eclipse, a pittance in the eyes of the incalculable distances of our journeying through the void. St. Ives sat back and fished in his coat for a cigar. Here was the Royal Academy, unutterably fearful of the machinations of Ignacio Narbondo, certain, that is, that the doctor was not talking, as it were, through his hat. If they could trust to Narbondo to destroy the Earth through volcanic manipulation, then they could quite clearly trust St. Ives to save it by the same means. What was good for the goose, after all? St. Ives took a breath and continued. There's been some study of the disastrous effects of instep marching on bridges and platforms. Military study, mostly. My own theory, which abets Narbondo's, would make use of such study of the resonant energy expended by troops of synchronized marchers. Parsons grimaced and shook his head slowly. He wasn't prepared to admit anything about the doings of the nefarious doctor, and St. Ives's theories, while fascinating, were of little use to them here. Then there was this man Jones. Hadn't he been involved in certain ghastly lizard experiments in the forests of New Hampshire? Very ugly incident, that one, Parsons muttered sadly. One of your Hollow Earth men, wasn't he? Had a lot of Mesozoic reptiles dummied up at a waxworks in Boston, as I recall. And insisted he'd found them, sporting in some bottomless cavern or another. Parsons squinted shrewdly at St. Ives. It was real science they'd ordered up here. Humanity cried out for it, didn't they? Wasn't Lord Kelvin at that very moment riveting together the carcass of the device that Parsons had described? Hadn't St. Ives been listening? Parsons shrugged. Discussions with St. Ives were always, how should one put it, revealing. But St. Ives had gotten in out of his depth this time, and Parsons' advice was to strike out at once for sure, a hearty breaststroke so as not to tire himself unduly. He patted St. Ives on the sleeve, waving the wine decanter at him. St. Ives nodded and watched the secretary fill his glass to within a centimeter at the top. There was no arguing with the man. And it wasn't argument that he wanted now anyway. It was action. The manor house and laboratory of Langdon St. Ives sat some 3/4 of a mile from the summer house of William Thompson, Lord Kelvin. The River Nid ran placid and slow between, slicing neatly in two the broad meadow that separated the grounds of the manor from the grounds of the summer house. The willows that lined the banks of the Nid affected a rolling green cloud bank that almost obscured each house from the view of the other, but from St. Ives' attic window, Lord Kelvin's broad, low barn was just visible atop a grassy knoll. In and out of that barn trooped a platoon of white-coated scientists and grimed machinists. Covered wagons scoured along the high road from Kirkhamerton, bearing enigmatic mechanical apparatus, and were met at the gates by a man in military fatigues, who poked his head in under tarpaulins in search, perhaps, for unwelcome sightseers or for agents of Dr. Ignacio Narbondo. St. Ives watched their comings and goings through his spyglass. He turned a grim eye on Hasbro, who stood silently behind him. "I've come to a difficult decision, Hasbro." "Yes, sir?" "I've decided that we must play the role of saboteur, and nothing less. I shrink from such deviltry, but far more is at stake here than honor. We must ruin, somehow, Lord Kelvin's machine." "Very good, sir." "Doing so, of course, necessitates not only carrying out a plan to manipulate the volcanoes, but implies utter faith in that plan. Here we are setting in to thwart the effort of one of the greatest living practical scientists and to substitute our own feeble designs in its stead, an act of monumental egotism."
"As you say, sir."
"But the stakes are high, Hasbro. We must have our hand in this. It's nothing more or less than the salvation of the Earth, secularly speaking, that we engage in."
"Shall we want lunch first, sir?"
"Kippers and gherkins, thank you, and bring up 2 bottles of Double Diamond to go along with it, and a bottle or two for yourself, of course."
"Thank you, sir," said the redoubtable Hasbro. "You're most generous, sir."
"Very well," mumbled St. Ives, striding back and forth beneath the exposed roof rafters and knuckling his brow. He paused and squinted out into the sunlight, watching another wagon rattle along into the open door of Lord Kelvin's barn. Disguise would avail them nothing. It would be an easy thing to fill a wagon with unidentified scientific trash, heaven knew they had any amount of it lying about, and to dress up in threadbare pants and coat and merely drive the stuff in at the gate. The guard would have no inkling of who he was, but Lord Kelvin, of course, would. A putty nose and false chin whiskers would be dangerous things. If any member of the Academy saw through them, they'd clap them in irons, accuse them of attempted sabotage, of seeking the destruction of the world. He could argue his case well enough in the courts, to be sure. He could depend on Rutherford, at least, to support him. But in the meantime, the Earth would have exploded. That wouldn't answer. And if Lord Kelvin's machine were put into operation and were successful, then he'd quite possibly face a jury of 2-headed men and a judge with a 3rd eye. They'd be sympathetic under the circumstances. But still. He paused and pressed his face into his hands. They'd have to brass it out, striding in, grinning, offering their services. Parsons would be there. Would he have them pitched out? Quite possibly. But in the meantime, between the 4 of them, they'd surely see some opportunity, some little chink in the armor of Lord Kelvin's apparatus. Who could say what it would consist of? Subtlety, thought St. Ives, as the top of Hasbro's head hove into view on the steep stairs, was worth a fortune. The vast interior of Lord Kelvin's barn was awash with activity, a sort of carnival of strange debris, a coiled copper, tubs of bubbling fluids, rubber-wrapped cable thick as a man's wrist hanging from the overhead joists like jungle creepers. A vast globular device shuddered beneath laboring welders and riveters square in the center of the floor, and Lord Kelvin himself, talking through his beard and clad in a white smock and Leibniz cap, pointed and shouted and squinted with calculating eye at the dread machine that piece by piece took shape in the lamplight. Parsons stood beside him, leaning on a brass-shod cane. At the sight of Langdon St. Ives standing in the sunlight outside the open door, Parsons' chin dropped. St. Ives glanced at Jack Owlsby and Hasbro. Bill Kraken had disappeared. Parsons raised an extorting finger, widening and squinting his eyes at the same time, with the curious effect of making the bulk of his forehead disappear into his thin gray hair. "Parsons!" cried St. Ives, getting in before him. "Your man at the gate is a disgrace. We sauntered in past him mumbling nonsense about the Atlantic cable and showed him a worthless letter signed by the Duke of Windsor. He tried to shake our hands." "You've got to do better than that, Parsons. We might have been anyone, mightn't we? Villains of any sort. And here we are, trooping in like so many ants." It's a great good fortune of the Commonwealth that we're friendly ants. In a word, we've come to offer our skills, such as they are. St. Ives paused for breath and bowed almost imperceptibly. Parsons sputtered like the burning fuse of a fizz bomb, and for one dangerous moment St. Ives was fearful that the old man would explode, would pitch over from apoplexy, and that the sum of their efforts would turn out to be merely the murder of poor Parsons. But the fit passed. The secretary snatched his quivering face back into shape and gave the three of them an appraising look, stepping across so as to stand between St. Ives and the machine, as if his gaunt frame, pinched by years of a weedy vegetarian diet, would somehow hide the thing from view. "Persona non grata, is it?" asked St. Ives, giving Parsons a look in return, then instantly regretting the action. There was nothing to be gained by being antagonistic. "I haven't any idea how you swindled the officer at the gate," said Parsons evenly, holding his ground, "but this operation has been commissioned by His Majesty the King and is undertaken by the collected members of the Royal Academy of Sciences, an organization, if I remember aright, which does not count you among its members. In short, we thank you for your kind offer of assistance and very humbly ask you to leave along with your ruffians." He turned to solicit Lord Kelvin's agreement, but the great man was sighting down the length of a brass tube, tugging on it in order, apparently, to line it with an identical tube that hung suspended from the ceiling 15 feet away. "My lord," said Parsons, clearing his throat meaningfully, but he got no response at all and gave off his efforts when St. Ives seemed intent on strolling around to the opposite side of the machine. "Must we make an issue of this, sir?" Parsons demanded of St. Ives, stepping along in an obvious effort to cut him off, and casting worried looks at Hasbro and Jack Owlsby, as if fearful that the two of them might produce some fearful device of their own from which to blow up the barn and exterminate the lot of them. St. Ives stopped, surprised to see Bill Kraken, grimed with oil and wearing the clothes of a workman, step out from behind a heap of broken crates and straw stuffing. Without so much as a sideward glance at his employer, Kraken hurried to where Lord Kelvin fiddled with the brass tube, grasped the distant end of it, and offered his services. In a moment he was wrestling with the thing, hauling it up this way and that to the apparent approval of his lordship, and managing to tip St. Ives a broad wink in the process. There was clearly no way of getting around Parsons short of knocking the man down, and such an action hardly seemed justifiable. "Well, well," said St. Ives in a defeated tone, "I'm saddened by this, Parsons, saddened. I'd hoped to lend a hand." Parsons, seeming mightily relieved all of a sudden, cast St. Ives a wide smile. "Thank you, sir," he said, limping toward the scientist, his hand outstretched. "If this project were in the developmental stages, I assure you we'd welcome your expertise. But it's really a matter of nuts and bolts now, isn't it? And your genius, I'm afraid, would be wasted." He ushered the three of them out into the sunlight, grinning now, and stood atop the knoll, watching until he was certain the threat had passed and the three were beyond the gate. Then he called round to have the gate guard relieved. He couldn't, he supposed, have the man flogged, but he could see to it that he spent an enterprising year patrolling the thoroughfares of Dublin.